From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, why nurturing entrepreneurship and innovation are crucial to making Wisconsin's and the nation's economy strong. Then the importance of a global approach when marketing those innovations.
Design, business, personal expression are coalescing now and coming to life in some of today's great brands. You know, I think students right now have a wonderful opportunity to think bigger about design.
Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton flies high with NASA this month, and a novel's protagonist is brought to life on stage through words and music.
It's just so much more fun, more immediate, more visceral, more real, given that it's the story of a musician and a performing artist.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The United States has always had a culture of entrepreneurship. Our image as rugged individualists goes hand in hand with Americans' reputation as inventors and innovators. With the decline in manufacturing and the era of globalization, however, there's perhaps even less of a guarantee of success than there used to be. But a number of organizations have sprung up to help give better odds to would-be inventors. In Milwaukee, one longtime business executive heads up a group that's been at work, taking a regional approach to the issue for more than 5 years. Dan Steiniger is the co-founder and president of BizStarts Milwaukee. He's the former chairman and CEO of the Catholic Equity Fund and also runs an innovation consulting firm. Steiniger talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the latest in a series of conversations recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club in Milwaukee. Steiniger explains why he believes innovation needs a helping hand in 2014.
Well, if we're going to talk specifically about Wisconsin, you are right. We have a great entrepreneurial history here. We are the home of many Fortune 500 companies, Harley-Davidson, JCI. These are great companies. Unfortunately, we lost a lot of our leadership. And now what happens? Where is that entrepreneurial spirit in Milwaukee? And everybody's talking about job creation. It's number one. It's headlines in the paper all the way. Well, where do jobs come from? Well, basically, they come from people starting companies. Well, let's face it, the Fortune 500 companies tend to grow and then they start to downsize. So where are the jobs going to come from? Well, that's why we now live in the world of Steve Jobs and innovation. So those are job creators.
Speaking of Wisconsin and Milwaukee specifically, are we a more risk-averse place than some other parts of the country? You mentioned Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs did not become Steve Jobs in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I think it's, you're absolutely right. I think it's a part of the history of success. When you become successful at something, as we did, and become a highly successful entrepreneurial economy, Milwaukee helped us win World War II. Our products were known all over the world. Like any great success story, it becomes your problem. And we apparently lost our leadership. A lot of those jobs went elsewhere. A lot of those companies went elsewhere. We lost a lot of giants. And we didn't fully recover. So we have a unique problem in Wisconsin, and that is overcoming the crash and burn that we've gone through. And yes, and so it isn't just a lack of risk, it's shell-shocked. People just can't. We grew up in a culture where everybody worked for somebody, and that era is suddenly gone, and we've been adrift, and things have got very, very serious. Our loss of jobs was huge. So yeah, we are still in mourning in many ways, and we're finally coming out of it.
Well, so how does Milwaukee shape the solution?
Well, the first thing is government's not going to solve this, that's for sure. We really are going to save it because individuals are going to stand up and say, the time has come for me to start businesses. And we have all the resources here. We just have had a poor impression of ourselves because of what happened to us. Our self-esteem went down. But now we're living in a region. We have, UW-Madison has a billion-plus research budget. We do over $300 million of academic research in this region. These are incredibly smart professors with patents and ideas and technology that could grow to companies. We have a culture and a genetic code that says we should start companies. It's starting to happen here. It's sort of exciting to be part of that now.
Explain where BizStarts and where BizForge, the evolution of BizStarts, fits into this equation.
Okay, let's turn the clock back a few years ago when we started BizStarts. If you wanted to start a company, where did you go? Okay. Did you learn how to start a company in high school? Did you learn how to start a company in college? Did you get a graduate degree in it? No. Nobody knew how to start companies, and you didn't know where to go to get help. So we had no place to go. So we started BizStart. So people who wanted, it's 501c3, and so they could go to get help to start a company. What does it take? What do I need? And more importantly, maybe I shouldn't do it. Maybe I shouldn't mortgage the house and all the other strategies that come with starting a business that don't work, because there's a lot of failure rate. So now there's a place finally where you can go to get the help to start a company. So that's number one on the radar. Number two is, okay, are all the people at BizStart geniuses that can help you? They can help. But because all of us who are involved in BizStart have run companies, scale companies successfully. But we've learned that any business succeeds because you have a lot of resources available to you. So in launching BizForge, and Forge is from that whole idea, what do I know? I've never forged anything in my life, but it's where you take hot metal and you can shape it and turn
forge
it into
a good Milwaukee kind of term.
It's a good Milwaukee term, and we have a lot of pictures from the Grohman Art Museum of forges. And we're actually going to have a blacksmith who has his own forging business that's going to be we're not going to cut the ribbon, we're going to slam the anvil. So, but basically, we're expanding it to have one place where you can get all the resources you need. So that'll include access to capital. We have partnerships with the academic institutions, UW-Whitewater, UWM, MSOE. What they're doing is helping us assess your business. So you've now invented the latest widget in your mind. It's a square wheel. So, okay, great. Bring it down. Let's find out if there's a market and find out whether or not this product would actually sell. We all have dreams. They'll come to, we got 4 billion people who want to use my product. Right. Well, let's prove it. So you can get that assessment. We have lawyers and accountants who will give some free time to talk to you about what you need to put together a business and what it takes. We're working with the city to pilot a program where you get accelerated permitting, so you know what you have to do permitting if you're, let's say, starting a restaurant or a car wash or whatever it is. You just haven't had a place to go to find out all the resources you need, and we have partnerships with them. And they'll help you and give you some free time to understand what it takes to grow your business. So,
when you look across disciplines at the whole spectrum of businesses, you know, whether it's a restaurant or a blacksmith or an e-startup, what is it that successful people in this world innately understand?
If you're thinking about being an entrepreneur, the number one thing, the number one quality you have to have is a willingness to say, I see a problem. Every great entrepreneur I know starts with an identification of an important problem, a need in people's lives. And if you have a burning desire to solve that need, then you know you have what it takes to be an entrepreneur.
So conversely, is where things typically go wrong that someone has come up with a solution without the problem to go with it?
Yeah, they need to first. You know, everyone has all sorts of great ideas of what they think the world needs. Business is all about finding things that people will pay money for. And so you may have the greatest square wheel in the world or square circle in the world, but unless someone's going to buy the thing, so you've got to have a problem. And consumers buy things that to solve. Consumers have problems they want solved. And if you're an entrepreneur, can solve some of their problems, whether you're a patient in a hospital, whether you're someone who needs their car washed, whether you're someone who wants their hair done at a hair salon, and I will tell you, there are more people employed in hair salons than are at Harley-Davidson. So to the point that we need hair salons, for crying out loud. And so, but you're going to have to address a problem that people have in their lives, and they're willing to pay for it. So that's what we help people understand.
So we turned the clock back to what led to the creation of BizStart. So let's turn the clock back even further. And I'm curious, how did your experience as a Peace Corps volunteer inform this work that you do today?
I was in Kenya, East Africa. Now everyone knows Kenya because the father of the president was from there. But I taught in an upcountry, rural area, very poor. But the students graduated from our high school, and only about 10% of the kids ever got to go to high school. And when they graduated, they had done very well. They had succeeded on an exam administered out of England called the Cambridge Overseas Exam. And it was the same exam that students in England took. And I had classes where 50% of the kids, these are Kenyan Africans, had Division I, mean A's. They studied. I had to go in the dorms at night, and they didn't have electricity. They had oil lamps studying by. These kids studied. You couldn't believe how hard they studied. They were fabulous. Now they graduate. They've done well. And I said, so what are you going to do? They said, oh, sir, we're going to South Africa. I said, South Africa? There's apartheid down there. And they said, yes, but we can get jobs. The Kenyan economy wasn't creating jobs. And it began to realize that jobs are what give people dignity. Having work, it helps to find you in the world in a way you haven't been. It gives you, allows you to provide for people you love. And more importantly, you get the feeling that someone's paying me for this. I must be worth something. And so it began to realize how important job creation was. So I put that in the back of my mind. And all through the years, I was a lawyer and then a CEO. You know, I had other points. But when I'm freed out of those, I always say I'm a recovering lawyer and a recovering CEO. But freed from that, I'm now being able to focus on job creation. And that, and we can wait for big companies to hire people, and that can and cannot happen. But it isn't happening fast enough. So now we're saying to people, we're living in a world, but never before in the history of the world have there been more, there's more potential to start a company. You've got the internet, you've got access to wireless phones, you have 3D printing, they have a $1,000 3D printer, less than $3,000, you can actually manufacture it in your own house now. This is a world we've never seen before, and it's a revolution of epic proportions, and now it's freeing up people to do things they've never done before. So this is an exciting time for entrepreneurship.
Well, and I wonder if that experience in Kenya exposed you to the idea of brain drain and made you sensitive to the idea that, you know, you can do all the education in the world, but if the jobs aren't where the education is, you're going to be in the cycle.
Mitch, you're very insightful. Obviously, you do your homework. I mean, and we are spending a lot of money in MPS and pouring millions into future lawyers and doctors and Come on. How about training kids in the more impoverished areas how to start a business? You did Steve Jobs, Michael Dell have college degrees? No. Did Bill Gates have a college degree? No. But you know, you can teach people to start a business. Okay? And so these are things that I've learned, that starting a business is a different skill set than what you learn in school. I'm not degrading what school's all about. It's wonderful. I've obviously got a PhD myself in law, but you really need to teach people how to start businesses. High failure rates, so they need skills to succeed.
Well,
so,
what's the role of business schools in all of this, if you can do this without necessarily having a college degree?
Business schools are pretty much have historically been geared to teaching people how to work in big companies. So when you have $100 million in revenues, now you can study to be an accountant or the CFO, or you have a marketing department. So they're not really geared. Now they're beginning to introduce some courses in entrepreneurship. But I love the story of a woman in New York who came up with some incredible recipe for cookies or whatever it was. And someone in the New York Times loved it and wrote a review of it, right? Now she's getting calls in her apartment where she's cooking these, baking these cookies, or saying, we'd like to talk to your marketing department. And she's thinking, marketing department? I'm washing dishes in my bathtub. So business schools historically have been geared to people who want to go to work for Fortune 100, 500 companies. We really haven't trained people to be entrepreneurs. It's just not been part of our historic mission in schools. So, you know, there's no reason that people can't. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to start a business.
Well, Dan Steininger, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mitch. You did your homework. Much appreciated.
Dan Steininger talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in a conversation recorded at the University Club in downtown Milwaukee. Steininger is co-founder and president of Biz Starts Milwaukee. There's a link to more about the organization, including the grand opening of its BizForge initiative, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The head of the Chicago marketing and design firm VSA Partners, who counts Harley and GE among his company's clients, will be speaking at MIAD tonight. We'll talk with him next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Twice a year, the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design hosts the Creativity Series. Founded by Madeline and David Lubar, the series brings artists and other creative thinkers to the school to work with students and faculty. The guest or guests also participate in a public program as well, usually involving a lecture and a Q&A session. Tonight, the fifth installment of the Creativity Series gets underway with Dana Arnett's talk called Change is Possible. Arnett is the founding principal and CEO of VSA Partners, a brand and marketing firm that's based in Chicago. The firm counts Harley-Davidson, IBM, GE, and Kraft among its clients. Arnett joins me on the line from Chicago now. Dana Arnett, welcome to Lake Effect. It is such a pleasure to speak with you this morning.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.
You're going to be here at the next MIAD Creativity Series. You're giving a talk called Change is Possible. And I wanted to start right there. To me, change is inevitable. So what do you mean when you say change is possible?
The idea around that talk title is essentially to provide students who are going to be primarily the audience that we'll be sharing the talk with this idea that design has far more possibilities, especially in today's world, than maybe the contextual view you get in your curriculum. So we're seeing a revival in design where design thinking, the creation of design expression across multiple mediums that take into account everything from graphic design to environmental design to sustainable design. Just because you get a degree in maybe a specific area or emphasis of design doesn't mean the possibilities are closed. So my thinking there around change is possible, there's a bigger change happening in the marketplace that creates opportunities for designers, and there's also a bigger view around how you can design your own career. And that is a change of thinking that is alive, and you know, that's sort of what I get up on my soapbox and talk about, is to give students an aspirational view of design.
That's a great way to think about it, that aspirational, because design permeates everything we do, but I don't think a lot of us think about it.
Right. You know, I had the good fortune of entering the design field right at the beginning of the 80s, and I went to work for a gentleman by the name of Robert Vogel, who had come up through what I would say the significant mid-century era of design, where there was this bigger revival of humanism brought to life by Walter Papke and Raymond Loewy and Mies van der Rohe, a lot of which happened here in Chicago. And Bob, you know, those were his mentors and contemporaries. And, you know, if we say past is prelude, those ideals of modernism when it comes to design, like creating adjacencies and harmony with thinkers, leaders, artists, I am actually seeing a revival of that. So when you think about companies like Apple, when they launch a product, for instance, when they launched the iPod, they didn't just think about the product design, which is exquisite, but they thought about a bigger way to think about music. Again, I believe that kind of thinking, and you can read about it in Isaacson's book on jobs, that he came from that spiritual place where design, business, personal expression are coalescing now and coming to life in some of today's great brands. So, you know, I think students right now have a wonderful opportunity to think bigger about design.
One of the things that you're quoted as saying is you have to have a creative mindset to solve today's complex business problems. And it sounds like what you're saying is that people coming into this need to be able to think in lots of different ways, not just one way about a problem.
Right. I mean, first of all, we're living in a modern world of increasing commoditization. So there's a primary source of what I would say a business advantage is creatively looking at solving big brand challenges. And those brands, typically a lot of the ones we work with here at VSA, they are now activated across multiple channels, mobile, social, retail, thought leadership, Wall Street in terms of the investor's view. And designers are just born with this insatiable desire to create context, but also this desire to make meaning out of words, pictures, writing. And I think that ambidextrous approach or that right brain approach is extremely relevant in a world where there's mass information, mass channels. Designers are sitting in a perfect place to help create meaning. You know, I think designers love the fact that they can be part of that dialogue now, and they're not sort of looking at graphic design, for instance, in the corner of a room as sort of a decorative practice, if you will.
Or almost afterthought.
Right, right. And, you know, one of the things that we are embracing, and it's been a primary part of VSA's growth, is creating a group of individuals that collaborate and solve problems in a team configuration where there's design thinkers who have research and social science backgrounds and really understand sort of the human condition and the relevance of how brands and design can influence behavior. In the old days, you would say that those people never got together with designers, but now we have the advantage of bringing together those kind of minds, pairing them with designers as they think about how a brand is designed or expressed, for instance, in the social media world. How might a person experience a brand walking through a retail environment? You know, we really embrace this idea of bringing together multidisciplinary teams where design is still sort of the centerpiece, but you have a lot more of a refreshing and competent view when you have team members that bring real perspective and insight to the table.
Who are feeding into it from their particular perspectives, but all with that greater goal in mind.
Yeah, and I think what differentiates maybe some of the design thinkers and our research and data people here is they all believe in creativity. So we're not trying to overwhelm the problem-solving process with quantitative data. There's a lot of rich content and data that exists ethnographically through social sources of understanding the way people live, behave, and act in the world. Creativity is the oil in the engine that lets all that input and insight in terms of design, it allows it to come together and work in one big motion.
How has that worked with companies? A lot of the companies that are in your portfolio have been around quite a long time and have obviously had to change with the times. Are they embracing this sort of whole earth approach?
You know, I think the most successful companies are, you know, we work and have worked a long time with IBM, with Harley Davidson, with GE, with Nike. A lot of these companies have chief design officers, or what I would call enlightened chief marketing officers, who understand that along with recognizing and addressing key audience drivers and delivering return on investment when it comes to marketing, that every day they have this obligation to differentiate their brand in the marketplace. Design helps create that sort of distinct difference. So, you know, in the old days where advertising was more based on, okay, if we get enough critical broadcast above and below the line media out there, we'll cover our butts and we'll get enough brand awareness and we'll bump audience. The game has totally changed now because people aren't sitting in front of TVs watching ads. They, you know, they're experiencing brands across multiple devices and multiple experiences. And so designers are now in a perfect place because they're used to designing experiences. We didn't grow up just designing great ads, hoping that a headline or a tagline might carry the day. The rules have changed. So again, this idea of change is possible is this call to action to students to think in bigger ways about their role as a designer as they go through their college experience and then enter the modern workplace.
I was thinking as you were talking about the different experiences of a brand that most of us skip over the ads now. So there has to be some other way that you get to the target audience.
Well, there are multiple ways to get to the target audience, and read it every day, this phrase out there, big data. So data has existed for years, and there's multiple sources that our strategy group sources data and segments and quantitative and qualitative and ethnographic data. And that's always going to be important because you want to understand who your customers are, how they behave, what drives their actions or purchase intent. But the real opportunity is what you do with the data. It's modeling predictive ways where the data can go to work and not just be used in a way to simply target a customer. It can be used in ways to influence this value chain from when they move from the brick-and-mortar store to the mobile device to conversations. Again, that's another exciting element or weapon in our design arsenal to take advantage of. The trick is to make sure the designers are sitting at the table with the strategists and they understand that data is less about the raw content or material. It's around how you model it.
I know you have a couple of days of going through and seeing projects and talking with students. What is the most important thing you want to see from them?
You know, I think the best designers, whether I'm interacting with them at a curriculum level or in a university setting or once we hire, what we're still looking for are people that are in love with creating unique and great ideas. The mediums, the methods, they're all going to change. So when I got out, you know, you're still cutting things out of paper and, you know, specking type by hand. But I will tell you, the knowledge you can get as a student around the essential, whether it's how do you conceive an idea or what makes a typeface beautiful or how does color and words and pictures, how do they come together to create a great idea? You know, great ideas are going to win. The mediums will change. The audiences will change. But we are always looking for designers, and I'm always sort of pushing that simple premise when it's in a classroom that that's the beauty of design. You know, as I think Harry Bertoia once said, the urge for great design is much like the urge to go on living. The assumption is somewhere hidden there's a better way of doing things. And so when you think about great designers over time, whether it be Paul Rand or Ray and Charles Eames or Eero Saarinen or Johnny Ives at Apple, they're idea-driven, and they believe in the fundamentals of form and function and expression, but they would never be where they were or where they are today without being big thinkers with a clear point of view and a great, great intensity that's deeply seated in creativity.
Dana Arnett, it is such a pleasure to talk with you. I am looking forward to your talk here in Milwaukee. Thanks so much.
Pleasure's mine. I'm looking forward to seeing you.
Dana Arnett is the founding principal and CEO of VSA Partners in Chicago. The company is known internationally for its award-winning design programs and marketing solutions. Clients include Harley-Davidson, GE, IBM, and Nike. Arnett is giving a talk at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design tonight as part of the MIAD Creativity Series. The talk is free and open to the public, and it begins at 6 p.m. Lake Effect's astronomy contributor is flying at 45,000 feet to collect data. We'll hear about what she hopes to find when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have you with us. And Gene Creighton is here. It is the last time we're going to talk to you before you actually fly in this very cool mission, Sophia. And probably when this airs, you will be in the air doing the research that you got chosen to do. So I want to just talk a little bit about that. I know we talked about that back in January when you first announced that you were going to be part of this. But remind us what this is and why you have to fly so high to get the data that you're going to be collecting.
I'm one of 24 people to go into SOFIA. So this is the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. It is a modified 747 with a 100-inch infrared telescope housed in it. My group is going to be Kathy Gustafson from Nicolet High School and I. And our goal is to get astronomical observations that then we can share with students, both at the high school, but also all kinds of students and general audiences who come to the planetarium. Sophia has to fly at 45,000 feet because primarily we need to get above the water vapor in the atmosphere, which absorbs a lot of the information that we're trying to see.
So the infrared gets kind of sucked up by the water
absorbed
vapor. So yeah, mm-hmm. So we can't see it down
we
here.
We cannot.
Okay.
So there are other ways of doing this. You can build observatories high in dry deserts. And that works, but you still have some water vapor to contend with. At 45,000 feet, you're above 99% of the water vapor in the atmosphere.
So is the data that you collect at that height then clearer and better quality than you would get on the ground?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So what in that spectrum are you looking for? What in the infrared spectrum, what kinds of things does that spectrum tell us about the universe?
I'm going to back up a little bit, Bonnie, to explain that. All we have basically for stars to get any information from them is their light. So to understand how we use that, we remind ourselves that light has a dual personality. We can imagine it as wavelengths, so like waves, and we can also imagine it as ping pong balls. We call them photons. You can imagine that, okay, here it is, the photon, boom, and I have a big bucket, and a 100-inch telescope is a big bucket, and I'm collecting as many of these ping pong balls as I can. Now, so infrared is just a small portion of the overall spectrum. We're sensitive to visible light, and that's, of course, a very small fraction of it. On the one hand, we have radio waves, which are super long. If we're thinking of waves, the wavelengths there from peak to peak can be miles long. And on the other side of the spectrum, we can have very, very short wavelengths we call gamma rays. And those can be smaller than an atom in length, which means that, thankfully, most of our atmosphere, especially with the powerful ones, absorbs those wavelengths, because if they were able to hit us, then we probably wouldn't be here.
On either end?
On the far end, the radio, we don't care because they carry very little energy. So we're okay with that. And in fact, a lot of the radio waves can be seen from the ground. So we don't have to go anywhere. We're just sitting there on Earth and we're collecting radio data. We've been doing that for now 60 years or so. But the really high end, the gamma rays, the X-rays, the ultraviolet, there we need to get above the atmosphere. But there's also a little other area where we need to get above the atmosphere, even though the infrared part of the spectrum doesn't carry all that much energy, but it is absorbed by the water vapor in the atmosphere. And because a lot of interesting things emit in the infrared, that's not a part of the spectrum that we're willing to give up.
So like what? What kind of interesting things happen in the infrared spectrum?
Well, for example, you emit an infrared.
I do.
You do. Our eyes can't see that. But if, for example, we were spies and we wanted to know how many people are in this room, we could have a spy satellite take a picture of this room and we would see two bright infrared sources and we would know, we wouldn't know who necessarily we are, but we would know that there are two people in the room.
So this is like the night vision goggles.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So the point now is that anything that is about the temperature that you and I are going to be emitting infrared radiation. Warmer things are going to be emitting infrared radiation too. And this is an interesting property of lots of matter. Most things in the universe emit light in a way that we call a black body radiation. If you start heating things up, they glow. And the more you heat them up, the more radiation they produce, the more light they produce. This is, I think, fairly intuitive. What perhaps is a little less intuitive is that the more I heat something, the more its peak radiation is going to turn toward bluer colors. And it can be blue literally if this thing is peaking, if most of the light that it's emitting is in the visible part of the spectrum. But when we say bluer, we just mean smaller wavelengths, more energy. By the way, the shorter the wavelengths, the more energy that photon carries.
Okay.
So far, so good?
Yep.
Okay. That means that when I look up, say, at Orion, there are all kinds of stars. And if you look carefully, some of them are very bright. You will notice they're not the same color. You will notice that the upper left shoulder of Orion, which has the marvelous name of Betelgeuse, at least in English, is much redder than the right knee of Orion, which is called Rigel, which clearly is a little blue, has a blue tinge to it. And when we look at those two stars, based on what I told you, that the hotter things will look bluer, Rigel is bluer, is intrinsically a hotter star than Betelgeuse is. So to give you an idea, Betelgeuse is about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. Rigel is about 30,000 Kelvin. Because of that, Rigel emits overall much more radiation than Betelgeuse does. In principle, right?
In principle, right.
I mean, if they were side by side, obviously they're not at the same distance, so that's going to get messed up what it looks like to us. But if we had them side by side, Rigel would be very bright because of how hot it is. So when we think about light, we have talked so far about things emitting light, right? So my star is busy emitting light. But then there are things in the universe that absorb light. So that water vapor is going to be sitting there thinking, I'm happy here sitting in the atmosphere of the Earth. Ooh, look at that photon that's coming my way. No, I can't take that photon because all elements have very specific allowed energies for electrons. So if a photon comes that cannot take it from one allowed level to another allowed level, then it has to let it go. But if it can, if that photon will take it from one allowed level to another, it will. And then it will absorb that photon. And if you're looking in that direction, those photons will tend to be missing. They will re-emit after a while, but they won't re-emit necessarily in the direction they came from. So that means it will be a deficit. So you'll be looking in that infrared source, let's say in the background there, but if there was some water molecules in between, then they will absorb those lovely photons that I was trying to look at. And yes, it will re-emit at some point in time and sometimes very soon, but it will re-emit in all directions randomly. So the chances that I'll get back the photon that was my due is very small.
What came to my mind as you were describing that was almost like the water vapor is acting like a sponge. It sucks up the ones that it can, and then it's like somebody squeezes the sponge and it goes off into different directions.
Right.
And so the stream is disrupted.
Is disrupted. Okay. And depending on how much water vapor I have, it could be that I get very little indeed because it so gets so absorbed that I just don't get anything at all or very little. So if we want to study objects that are, again, relatively cool. So what would those objects be? Those objects would include all the asteroids. Those objects include stars that are so young that they are surrounded by all this gas and dust that gets re-emitted, that re-emits some of that energy that the star buried within is shining. But that requires also infrared radiation. And perhaps one of my favorite infrared sources are young galaxies. So when we want to look at the universe when it was so long ago, when the galaxies were first forming, those tend to look good in the infrared.
So do you think you might be looking at some young galaxies in the infrared?
I sure hope so.
Yeah.
I sure hope so.
You won't know until you get up there, right?
I won't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. When you come back and we do our full debriefing, because you know we're going to, I want to hear every bit of it. Hopefully you'll have some information about some young galaxies.
I hope so. Out gallivanting
in the universe.
Oh, I love it.
Well, Jean, have a wonderful, safe trip. And it's Kathy, right, is your partner?
Kathy. Mm-hmm.
All right. You and Kathy have a wonderful time. And I so look forward to hearing about it when we talk next.
I'm so excited. Looking forward to it as well. Thank you, Vani.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the campus of UW-Milwaukee. She's flying high in the sky as we speak, collecting data for NASA's Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, or SOFIA, project. We'll take one last break and then talk with local musician Paul McComas next. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Let's get carried away.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Art, music, and literature often influence each other. A novelist might respond to a song, a playwright to a story, or a musician to a play. For Milwaukee native, author, and educator Paul McComas, all three happened on the same project. More than a decade ago, McComas began writing songs, channeling a character he had created named Dana Clay. The songs he wrote inspired his novel Unplugged, which detailed her struggles in the music industry and in life. Out of the novel came a stage adaptation of both the story and the songs, and the inspiration keeps coming. McComas recently updated the live show of Unplugged to include new music and a new onstage partner, Chicago singer-songwriter Maya Cooper. The pair will perform the stage version tonight for Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking, but first they stop by the Lake Effect Studios. McComas tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce more about his protagonist, the character who inspired it all.
She's 27, and she's a rock musician. That alone is trouble. This is the age that Hendrix, Joplin, Morrison, and Cobain never made it past. Drugs, despair, psychological confusion, and the interface between them take their toll, and they're taking it on Dana, who also happens to be a survivor of childhood rape. She has the opportunity that those other musicians did not get to step back from the brink and figure out a new way to be. And it's afforded to her largely by her engagement with nature in the Badlands of South Dakota. The title Unplugged has multiple meanings, but I guess the main one is that she removes herself from this crazy career track in order to figure out how to live and grow and heal and be, and then decide perhaps how much of herself to put back out there.
So Dana goes on this journey, which both you and Maya take the audience on as they watch this performance of her story on stage. How do you present the vignettes? How do you bring her story to life on stage through both word and music?
We have 12 scenes and songs, 6 of each, and they're in alternation so that we're constantly playing, I think, with dynamics. Song, scene, song, scene, song, scene, all the way to the end. So that, I think, keeps things lively and ever-changing. As for the arc of the piece, over the course of those 12, we take her from a place of utter despair and suicidal ideation to really transformation and transcendence all in an hour. Now, it takes a lot longer to actually read the book, but we're giving spectators, I think, a really vivid, visceral, live performance Cliff Notes version, in a sense, of the experience of the book.
Maya, tell me a little bit about the music and how the music works along with the words of the novel to bring Dana's story to life.
Dana's songs are written from her point of view, and they're very, I think Paul used the word visceral. She's writing about her experience. Things that you can't say necessarily in writing are easy to say in a song. And she's writing about her childhood rape. She's writing about her determination to overcome that. She's writing about being suicidal and what that means. And she's using metaphors that might be lost on some of her listeners. But to her, they mean, you know, what she's feeling. So in the spoken word parts of the show, we're able to explain the songs. You don't need to read the book to enjoy the songs, but they inform each other. The songs are mentioned in the book, and there's lyrics from the songs in the book, but there's also aspects that are not in the book that you get to hear in this show, including a new song.
Written by Maya that kind of fills in the gap at the end of what used to be the show and helps make it the new and better show. We needed a piece that is from Dana's point of view after these events have happened and she's come out the other end with new insights into herself and her world and a new determination to help others and to connect. And that song's called Carried Away, and it's the last thing we do. It's the 12th piece out of 12. I look at our show now and I have a hard time remembering how it worked at all without that song. It really is the capper. It's where everything else is heading toward.
Let's get carried away and rise above. Carried away in boundless love. I will carry you if you'll carry me. So let's throw all the rules out the window. Let's get carried away. Okay.
I feel like a lot of this show is emphasizing that power of music as a transformative tool.
Right. You know, I think that Dana, at one point in her life, she lives to write and perform. And at another point, she writes and performs In Order to Live. And it's all part of the same kind of cycle. I know that as myself, an artist who struggles sometimes with depression, there are times when that work is what gets me out of bed. That work is what allows me to put one foot in front of the other. And then there are times when I can't do that work at all. And one thing that that Dana is developing, and you see it in the book, I think you definitely see it in the show too, particularly as Maya performs the part, is that Dana becomes increasingly intuitive and self-aware, not solipsistic, not self-indulgent, but self-aware in a way that will then allow her to take an integrated version of herself into the world and help others. What's a real joy then in performance is watching this character that I've brought into being, who has a fair amount of me in her, brought fully to life on stage through the voice and the performance of my friend Maya. I just stand there a little bit agog because I thought this person up, and now for an hour, there she is. There she is in the flesh, you know, wowing a crowd just like Dana does when she's able.
What is that experience like for you, Maya, to not only go up there as a musician and perform, but almost be acting as well, channeling this character and bringing her and her life and her story to the fore?
It is definitely an acting job, mm-hmm. which is not normally what I do. But then again, where is the line? As a songwriter and sometimes performer, I'm a storyteller. And when you're acting, you're portraying a character, and I'm portraying a character. It's difficult, I gotta say. It's difficult to portray this character because I'm portraying a character who's had experiences that I haven't had and hope never to have. And so I don't know, you know, how authentic it is. But all I can do is just try to bring these words to life. And Paul has written this show in such a way that it is just moment after moment after moment of the grittiest parts of the story. It's the highest and the lowest points
right.
of the story on this roller coaster ride. It's difficult. It's difficult to play this character. You know, as long as I can just keep doing what I'm doing and just kind of give myself over to the material, then it sort of takes care of itself.
Right. We're bringing essentially a dozen moments to light into life in vivid detail. And I think that tells us more finally about Dana and the issues with which she's dealing than any kind of more summary or synoptic approach would.
Why was it so important to you to really bring those issues to light and through music in this stage version?
Mm-hmm. I've been interested in exploring and developing this nexus between, on the one hand, creative and performing arts, and the other, social conscience, progressive outreach, healing. And you could stand at a lectern and do a PowerPoint about rape and recovery, about depression, about Dana's struggle with her sexual identity. She's a bisexual woman who has suffered persecution from both the straight and the lesbian communities. But who really wants to sit and watch a lecture when you can watch a performer like Maya knock it out of the park and backed up by some decent musicians? It's just so much more fun, more immediate, more visceral, more real, I think, given that it's the story of a musician and a performing artist.
And it might be more accessible as well.
I think so.
What are you hoping that the audience takes away from Dana's story as you're presenting it on the stage?
Well, it is being done in the auspices of a program for the Center for Peacemaking at Marquette, which on the surface might seem a little unusual. They deal with situations like Congo. So why are they hosting this? Peace takes many forms. And I think until someone can achieve a certain level of inner peace, they're probably not going to be in peaceful relationships with others, which is always, I think, the ultimate goal. I hope that people will take from this show a number of things. That if they have been a victim of rape, abuse, or other trauma, that they must not let that be the last word, that they must move from victimhood into survivorhood, and that there are resources available. The Counseling Center at Marquette will be there with us for the Q&A. That if they're struggling with depression, mood disorders, or other psychological or psychiatric issues, or think that they might be, that again, they can and should get help. That if they are working on issues of identity, sexual identity or other, that they should just trust in their intuition and listen to themselves, and you are who you are, and don't worry too much about what other people say. And I guess I also hope that some aspiring artists out there and performers out there will witness our show and say, yeah, you know what? I should do something around social conscience too. And that some aspiring social workers and activists will look at our show and say, hey, maybe I should be working within the arts. That bringing these two together can only be win-win.
I really hope that people who need to get help are encouraged to do so by being exposed to this show and this book. It tells the story of a suicidal young woman who is finally able to find healing without lecturing.
My default is always towards character. And if you tell Dana's story, as we do through my writing and through Maya's performance, if we tell it right, we tell it authentically, there is implicit message and there is implicit politics in there. But we're not leading with the message. And so I think it actually delivers the message in a more convincing and potent way.
Well, Paul and Maya, I would love if you guys could give us a little preview, perhaps, of the performance.
Sure. What should we play?
You know what? We should do Little Church.
You want to do Little Church?
Yeah.
Okay.
Milwaukee native author and performer Paul McComas and Chicago singer-songwriter Maya Cooper performing Little Church in Lake Effect Studio B. They'll present Unplugged live tonight at Marquette University's Alumni Memorial Union. The event, sponsored by the Center for Peacemaking, will have a post-show Q&A and a book and CD signing to benefit the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, on whose National Leadership Council and Speakers Bureau McComas serves. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. All for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.
Damnation. Well, the congregation perked right up. They were shouting, amen, as he condemned all the folks who wouldn't make the cut.